Good afternoon. This is Luba Sobolevsky, and welcome to our program called Maybe You Should Talk to Someone with our expert guest, Lori Gottlieb. I apologize for starting this a little bit late. We were having a bit of technical issues, as one tends to have these days, but I think we have solved most of it, so I'm hoping you can hear me very clearly. And I also hope you're all doing well and are very safe today, and your families and your colleagues are doing well as well. And I'd like to welcome Lori Gottlieb to IGNS. Lori, thank you so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
Lori Gottlieb is a psychotherapist and New York Times bestselling author of a book called Maybe You Should Talk to Someone, which is being adapted as a television series with Eva Longoria. In addition to her clinical practice, she writes the Atlantic Weekly Dear Therapist Advice column and contributes regularly to the New York Times, the Atlantic, and many other publications. She's also a TED speaker and has written hundreds of articles related to psychology and culture, many of which have become viral sensations. She's a regular expert guest on the Today Show, Good Morning America, the CBS Early Show, CNN, and NPR's Fresh Air. And if you haven't yet looked up the book, Maybe You Should Talk to Someone, and you can see the snapshot of it on your screens, you should absolutely go out and get it. It's incredible. To all of you who are tuning in today, this program is a bit different from what IGNS programs have been, in that we're not going to talk about immune globulin, we're not going to talk about biologics, practice standards, et cetera. What we're going to talk about is mental health and the emotional toll life events, especially today during our pandemic, have taken on our life and our interaction with each other, and ways we can address this. And we'll seek Lori's expert advice as it relates to our teams, our patients, and ourselves. So Lori, again, welcome. And I'm just so excited to meet with you virtually. We live in the same city. We grew up around the same town and around the same time, which is funny how small this world really is. When I read your book last year and really kept coming back to it, I found it absolutely fascinating. It's based on real events and real people who are your clients in therapy. And it is raw, it's honest, it's funny, it's real. One of the characters in your book is you. And you chronicle your own experience seeking therapy. Can you tell us a little bit about what the impetus was to writing this book and being this vulnerable with your audience?
Yeah, so this wasn't the book that I intended to write. I was originally supposed to be writing a book about happiness. And at the time, I was just starting out as a therapist. And it felt like there was this big disconnection between what I was seeing in the therapy room and what I was writing about in terms of all these studies around happiness. Because I think as a therapist, what you come to see is that happiness as a byproduct of living your life in a meaningful way is what we all want. But happiness as the end goal tends to be a fruitless pursuit. And I really felt like what I saw in the therapy room was so much more interesting. There was so much, so many heroic moments, so much about the human condition, so much about struggle and joy and pain and transformation all interwoven. And so I decided to just bring people into the therapy room in this book, Maybe You Should Talk to Someone. And I follow the lives of four very seemingly different patients as they go through their struggles. And then there's a fifth patient in the book, and that fifth patient is me, as I go through my own struggle and go to my own therapist. So you see me as both clinician and patient in the book.
Which is so just an incredible angle. And I think that you learn as a reader so much about what the experiences of a client or a patient seeking therapy, and also the clinician's experience seeing someone. and that clinician also seeking therapy. And I just found there are so many lessons in this book across all the stories that you write and all the characters that it really does relate to the situation that we are in now globally with the COVID-19 pandemic. And to bring it sort of into our world, our industry, and to see the experience that you write about through our lens, our clinical field is represented by patients with rare and life-threatening chronic disorders. Our patients have a level of isolation already before the pandemic began. And so a lot of our patients couldn't go out and do things or were self-isolating for a number of reasons, including compromised immune system or physical disability and other factors. And now with COVID-19, this isolation and loneliness has become profound. And we also read about so much how stress and mental health can worsen, mental issues can worsen your physical health. And so it's front of mind to us as clinicians. How do we assess the need for mental health support among our patients? What would some of these red flags be as we now have less and less interaction? A lot of doctor's offices and practices have shut down and are doing more remote visits. Or if we're doing home visits with patients, we're limiting the time that we want the nurse to be in the patient's home for the protection of the patient and the nurse. So it feels that the time, the face time with our patients is really shrinking. What are those red flags? How do we assess patients' need? Can we talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I think it's really important to communicate to people that your emotional health is important. And I think that sometimes what happens is we think it's almost like optional to pay attention to our emotional health. So with our physical immune systems, of course, right now, with this virus going around, everybody is concerned about their physical immune systems. It sounds like your community, that's something that's chronic. But we don't pay as much attention to our psychological immune systems. And our psychological immune systems can easily get overwhelmed, especially with all of the stress and trauma and isolation and grief and loss that we're all going through. And so it's important to communicate to people that you don't need to be in some kind of crisis to reach out for help. I think when something feels off in our bodies, often we will call our physician and say, hey, I'm experiencing this symptom. I should get it checked out, you know, before something really bad happens. I think we don't do that with our emotional needs. What'll happen is if something feels off emotionally, we'll say, yeah, well, it's not that bad. You know, all these other people are suffering, or, you know, it's not, you know, it's okay. I can still kind of function. You don't need to get to a place of not functioning to reach out for help. I think that if you are feeling like, you know what, sometimes I'm feeling anxious or I'm a little bit overwhelmed or this is really hard, that you can just be as simple as this is really hard right now, maybe I should talk to someone. And it's very helpful because when you reach out to someone, and you know, the title of the book, Maybe You Should Talk to Someone, doesn't just mean you need to talk to a therapist. It means we all need to be talking more to one another. So I think it's important to make sure that people are reaching out to other people. We use this word isolated a lot, as if we are isolated, but we are physically distanced, but we're not isolated at all. You just pick up your phone and all of a sudden you're connected with somebody. So I think that the way that we need to remember that we can connect with people, and if it feels like a friend or a family member isn't maybe meeting your needs in terms of what you need to talk about, then by all means, I think we need to educate people that there are lots of ways to connect with a therapist right now, and it can be really helpful.
Right. And I agree with you. I think that we are isolating physically, but we don't have to isolate from each other and sort of hide and have no contact. In fact, there was a study that I read from many years ago where constant or continued phone calls to patients who were suffering from chronic illnesses reduced number of ER visits over some period of time. So it seemed like if the patients had someone to talk to on a regular basis from their clinical team, that alleviated a lot of the anxiety and maybe answered a lot of the questions they might have had about what's going on with their health. And that reduced their either perceived illnesses or it might have been an intervention that was needed on a timely basis.
Yeah, that's right. I think that people who have chronic illness often feel that they aren't necessarily seen or paid attention to because they're experiencing what they're experiencing 24 hours a day. And they only get to see their physician, at certain times. And so I think just knowing that they're kept in mind, I think having a chronic condition is incredibly isolating in a lot of ways. And so if somebody is checking in on them, it boosts your immune system. It makes you feel good to know that, wow, somebody is thinking about me. Somebody cares about me. This person that I'm relying on is paying attention.
Right. No, that makes sense. I'm just going to pause for a second to remind everybody that there is a question bar on the right side of your panel, and you can submit any of your questions there, and hopefully we'll get to answering some of them. So please do submit your questions. I have a question for you, Lori. I know that just from reading your book and listening to some of your programs, that you're not a big fan of therapy through FaceTime or Zoom. And I know that you've said it takes away from the energy between the therapist and the client. How has the current pandemic changed that view, if at all? Are you finding that you're seeing clients remotely now, and how has that changed that experience for you and your patients and your clients?
Yeah, you're right. Ordinarily, I much prefer in-person visits when we do therapy. I much prefer to work with somebody in the room. A colleague of mine had said that doing Skype therapy is like doing therapy with a condom on because there's a different energy, there's a different intimacy to being face to face with somebody, hearing them breathe, being in the space together, than there is being sort of mediated by a screen. But I will say at the same time, now that we're forced to do remote sessions, there's a certain intimacy to that too, because you're seeing inside people's natural environments and they're seeing inside mine. And, these very funny things happen. It sounds strange to say funny in the middle of a global pandemic, but when you think about it, a lot of people need to find a private place to do their therapy so that they aren't overheard by other people and can speak freely. And so sometimes that's maybe a back bedroom. Sometimes it's a closet. Sometimes it's a car. But sometimes it's sitting on the toilet in a bathroom, like sitting on a toilet seat, because that's the only place that they can get some privacy. Right. And there was this one woman that one patient I was talking to, and she was very worried about her mother, who had some underlying health conditions and was aging, and there was a confirmed case of COVID-19 that her mother may have been exposed to. And she was sobbing because she felt so helpless being thousands of miles away. And then she leaned back, and by accident, she flushed the toilet. And we laughed, and we hesitated to laugh. And then we laughed. And at the end of the session, she said to me, I really appreciate everything you said, to comfort me in this session. But the thing that felt the most comforting was laughing with you. She said, I think that we forget to laugh, when we're going through something like this. And she said, I realized I probably haven't laughed in a month. And so, I think there's the unexpected that happens when you do virtual sessions. People's kids or pets or partners, you might see in the background, or they walk in, and And you would hear, you know, I'd always heard stories about them, but now I get to see them and I see this person interact with them. And I think it feels like we're all going through the same thing. It feels like we're definitely all in this together when you realize that their home isn't very different from mine.
Well, that's actually an interesting point. It does humanize the experience. I think we've all had a large volume of these Zoom calls recently with unexpected guests arriving from time to time. And I think it does humanize everyone. And to a certain degree, I'm sure there is a benefit to it. So it's interesting to hear your take. So switching.
Yeah, I think it makes us feel less alone.
Agreed. Yeah. I want to talk about, we talked about our patients, and I want to talk a little bit about our own teams. I think it's safe to say that we all have experienced trauma in the last several months, a level of trauma with this pandemic. And clinicians in any field are experiencing and witnessing traumatic events. And I'm sure there will be ramifications later on, and post-traumatic stress and other issues. My question is, we all witness different levels of stress and trauma. Some of us are on the front lines, directly saving patients' lives and seeing patients die. Others are managing and deploying healthcare teams and putting in place guidance that will protect their employees and protect their patients. And that level of stress and those traumatic events are different and yet equal in magnitude. And still others in our industry are ensuring patients get the supply of products they need and make sure that their treatment is sustained. All of our patients are still having their chronic illnesses that were there before COVID-19, and they're still here. And so there are very different perspectives. And in your book, you talk about this hierarchy of pain. And I really, it resonated with me when I was thinking about this concept. And you describe it really well in your book. Can you talk about how that hierarchy of pain can relate to what we're seeing in just in different areas of our field?
Yeah. So in the book, I talk about how I don't think there's a hierarchy of pain, that a lot of people will minimize what they're going through because you can always compare your pain to somebody else's and find somebody who's hurting more. And so what I say in the book is pain and suffering is suffering. And you know, this isn't sort of the pain Olympics, right? So it's really important to acknowledge what you're feeling. And I think right now we're all experiencing this collective grief and collective loss and collective trauma. And it can be sometimes as healthcare providers, you know, we might look at what other people are going through and feel like, well, I'm not going to pay as much attention to what I'm experiencing because compared to these other people that I'm helping, that I'm treating, they have it so much worse. And we really need to acknowledge that whatever your losses are, they're real. And if you don't pay attention to them, they will catch up to you later. And right now they might be coming out in, let's say, an inability to sit still or a short-temperedness, or you're getting into arguments with people. You're getting you're irritable or you're easily frustrated. You're eating too much. You're drinking too much. You're spending too much time on the internet, which a colleague of mine says of the internet, that it's the most effective short-term non-prescription painkiller out there. Meaning, you know, it's like, it'll numb out your feelings, all these things, food, wine, you know, anything, the internet, they'll numb your feelings in the moment. But it's not a very effective way to manage and to cope with what we're experiencing. It's really important to be able to, without judging what you're feeling, to feel what you're feeling and to be really kind to yourself and you know, really compassionate with yourself. And when you're kinder to yourself and more compassionate with yourself, you're kinder and more compassionate with other people as well.
And I'm sure that a lot of our healthcare professionals generally over-normalize their experience and their pain and the stress, you know, I'm a nurse, so therefore I'm supposed to be stressed. I'm supposed to feel like I'm run down when this happens. And the same goes for pharmacists, physicians, people in the industry. I think we're all just saying, well, this is normal. We're in a crisis. And I don't think people are really pausing to take care of themselves and pausing to take care of their teams as well.
Right. It's a little bit like I get a lot of, you know, I write the Dear Therapist column for The Atlantic, and I get a lot of mail about, you know, how can I help my kids from parents? How can I help my kids through this? And I feel like as healthcare providers, we need to take the same advice that I give to parents, which is in order to be present for your children, you need to be present for yourself first. And the same thing as a healthcare provider, in order to be present for your patients, you need to be present for yourself. You will be of no use to people if you are not taking care of yourself. So I think it's really important that we realize that we have needs too, and we need to make sure that we are doing everything we can to care for ourselves, because we're human and our humanity is probably what drew us to the professions that we're in. Our humanity is the best gift that we can offer our patients is our humanity, and we will lose our humanity if we don't acknowledge that we too are human and we have needs and we need to take care of ourselves as well.
That is absolutely true, and I think that's really important to us to keep in mind that you can only do so much because you are human and you need to take time and allow yourself to decompress. So how do you decompress from treating clients, Lori? Do you have strategies that you can share with us perhaps that we could use in our practice?
I do. And I just want to preface it by saying, you know, I'm kind of figuring it out along with everybody else. So I can tell you what has worked for me, but I'm, you know, I want people to get creative and really figure out what works for them too. I think for me, it's really important to go to bed at the normal time and wake up at the normal time and make sure that I shower every day and put on clothes, even if those clothes are sweatpants, that I make my bed, because I think it just kind of makes you feel, you know, there's a distinction between sort of night and day. And that you eat your meals at regular times. It's really important to give ourselves fuel. So, you know, don't skip meals because you forgot to eat because you were too busy taking care of other people. Don't eat lunch at 4 p.m. Make sure you eat your meals at you know, regular times so that you are fortified. And I think also, you know, just really being easier, not harder on ourselves right now. I think that the tendency is to say, well, I have to step it up now because of everything that's going on. And I want to say to people, step it down. You know, think of like one or two things that you need to accomplish the next day and do those one or two things, but don't put 20 things on your list. And then at the end of the day, you feel like a failure because you didn't get the laundry done or you didn't get whatever done, right? So I think just being really gentle with myself and realistic and prioritizing and saying, these are the things that I have to do. And these are the things where I'm responsible to other people. And then these are the ways that I can kind of let myself off the hook. And I think one last thing is really important, which is I think what I said earlier about laughter and joy, that laughter and joy can coexist with pain and challenge. I think, you know, if you happen to be with family members, you know, play board games, binge watch a TV show together, you know, cook together, laugh together. Get outside, move your body, meaning, you know, even if it's just to walk outside and walk up and down the block for 5 minutes, just get outside. Change of scenery can do wonders and can kind of really psychologically reset you. You know, those are the things that I've been doing.
That's really helpful. Absolutely. And speaking of sort of taking care of yourself and doing things for yourself, as a clinician and as a therapist, do you ever feel that you just need to deal with your own emotions? Like that's the expected weight of your profession? Do you have any trepidations in asking for help, maybe with a therapist or, as you said, with any other means of maintaining mental health and well-being?
Yeah, that's such a good question because, you know, I think it's really imperative that we do reach out and that we do walk the talk. So yeah, I called my therapist and I said, you know, I need to talk during this time because there's a lot that's incoming right now, and I need a place to really process what's going on. And I think the other thing is, I when you talk about trepidation and taking care of oneself, I've learned to say no in a better way. So I think in normal times, you know, as a healthcare provider, you have to learn to say no, because otherwise your life will be hijacked, you know, by your work, even if the work is very meaningful. And so I think that even in these times, you know, especially in these times, it feels even harder to say no. If someone says, you know, I need to talk and I can't wait until tomorrow, well, let's assess what that means by you can't wait until tomorrow, because usually they can wait until tomorrow. And so if someone, you know, do they really need to talk at 9 o'clock p.m. or can we talk at 9 o'clock a.m.? So those kinds of things, being able to really say no and make sure that I'm protecting myself. And for example, with my sessions, not doing them back to back to back to back, but making sure that I have a break in between. Maybe I have, you know, half an hour in between a session, or if I'm doing several, that I make sure that I have a break so that I'm making sure that I'm giving the best of myself to other people. And not just kind of powering through, but kind of phoning it in.
Right. That's really important. And I know it's sometimes very difficult because we are usually scheduled back to back to back. But it's crucial, I feel. Otherwise, it's just going to get down to a breaking point. So, yeah, thank you for that. I know that our timing got a little bit shifted. So I do have one more question for you, and then we'll take maybe a question or two from the audience, if you don't mind.
Okay.
How do you find the right fit for mental health? And do doctors, nurses, pharmacists, healthcare professionals, do we need a different type of therapist or a different approach due to work-related trauma than someone who isn't in this profession, for example?
Yeah, I think that the fit is really important. And in fact, study after study shows that the most important factor in the success of someone's therapy isn't the clinician's modality that they're using or their number of years of training. It's really the relationship. So those other things matter, of course, so don't get me wrong, they matter, but they don't matter as much as the fit. So I think that when people make an appointment with a therapist, they feel like, well, I'll go to a session, I'll see how it goes, and either I'll stay in therapy or I'll leave therapy. But it's not like that. You're really going for a consultation and you're saying, what do I feel like in the room with this person, or now in the virtual room with this person? Did I feel understood? Did I feel like this person got me, you know, as much as someone can get you in the course of one session? And if so, then go back for a second one. But if not, trust your gut. If that wasn't the right person for you, you can find somebody else. And I don't think that we need somebody specifically who has experience being, you know, doing exactly the job that you do. I think that people understand. I think that most clinicians understand very well trauma and challenge and the challenges of the kind of work that you know any healthcare provider does.
Thank you. Thank you. So now we have a lot of questions. Let's get to maybe one or two if we have time. I think we have maybe 1 or 2 minutes left. What are some resources that organizations like healthcare organizations, specialty pharmacies, or infusion clinics can utilize to support their employees during the pandemic?
Yeah, I don't know of specific resources, but I do know that there are many out there. And I think what I've been seeing is that they're really about making sure that people are paying attention to their employees, and they're looking, you know, they're making sure that people feel safe. And the biggest thing that I've heard from patients who are going to work is that they're worried that their employers are not paying attention to their safety. You know, like there aren't enough. There's not enough protective gear. There aren't enough breaks. You know, just things like that. You know, they don't have a clean bathroom to use. You know, I mean, really basic things like that. And so I don't have specific resources, but I know that's what I'm hearing.
Thank you. Well, thank you very much, Lori, for this enlightening conversation and your guidance. Lori's book, Maybe You Should Talk to Someone, is available now, and it's fantastic. And I really encourage all of you to go out and get it and read it. Please tune in next Thursday afternoon for our webinar, Be Needle Fear Friendly, presented by Dr. Amy Baxter, who is the inventor of Buzzy. After this web program, you'll receive an email and a link to the recording that you can view at a later time. Lori, again, thank you so much for sharing your expertise. And thank you to the audience. Please be safe, and we'll see you soon.
Thank you so much for the conversation. Stay safe.
Thank you.